the other one. So in Virasoro, so in the wheel, we have a length, n over all integers. And in the Virasoro, we have ln for all integers. And then we have an extra generator, C, which is central. And being central means that it commutes with everyone else. So, OK, so I didn't write down explicitly this, but the central, this operator, which is just a proportional to the identity, commutes with the rest of the Virasoro generator. So what you do is add one extra generator to the Virasoro algebra, but it's a very mild extension because it's an operator that commutes with all the width generator and just appears on the right-hand side of the commutator of two Virasoro.
But like, you know, these LNs and of Dewitt algebra and Virasoro algebra, are they related?
Well, so for example, for n, equals 0, 1. I mean, this is an abstract algebra. So as algebras, they're different, right? I mean, I could use a different name. So they're definitely different. They're different algebras, the width algebra and the Virasoro algebra. But for a subset of the generators, for example, when n equals 0, 1, and minus 1, it's the same one.
I mean, like, in Dewitt algebra, we expanded the formal transformation in terms of this generator.
Yes.
And then we get a conserved current.
Yes.
And then we expand the conserved current in terms of these LNs.
Yes.
So how these operations are related?
So it's,
I try to find the relation between them because there should be a relation between them because
so if you want, I mean, if for example you're studying the classical theory, so imagine you study explicit CFT like a free scalar. And you write down the this C. Okay, so another way of saying it is that this C is due to a quantum effect. Okay. So you start with a classical theory, and now imagine you want to compute the, and I think you did that yesterday, you want to compute the central charge of the free scalar conformal field theory. So when now using the fact that you have a contraction, so you have normal order of operators, and you have a free field contraction between the stress tensor and the field itself, there's an extra contribution that's not there in the classical theory that gives you the central charge. So the deformation from here to here, you can think of it as due to a quantum effect. When you define composite operators like the stress tensor, you have to renormalize them. And that introduces this central term. Maybe it will become more familiar. Today we will add one more tutorial on this kind of how, when you renormalize composite operators, how this gives rise from, how does this modify, say, the width to Virasoro, and we can do it maybe for the free fermion.
Okay, yeah.
But remember, this was a very naive classical analysis of classical vector field. And here, when we compute C, it's really you're computing the quantum OPE of two objects. And that can receive quantum correction. If I have kept h bars, which I didn't, the C in some sense is proportional to h bar. So it's a quantum effect. All I'm saying is that the appearance of this central term is due to a quantum effect from the weak contraction. OK, I don't need to read that. So. Any other questions? Sorry. OK, so we're talking about the operator state correspondence. And what we saw is that what we did is we studied the representations of the Virasoro algebra. We saw there was this infinite dimensional representation that you construct by starting with the highest or lowest weight state, H, and we constructed a basis of the representation by taking with this canonical ordering. Okay. And this operator was the highest weight, which meant that highest weight of the scaling weight H, that means that it had eigenvalue H with respect to the L0 generator. And it was killed by all lowering operators. Okay. Now, in class, what we had seen is that we can construct the state H. So given a primary phi, so we can construct this family, this infinite dimensional representation, starting from a primary, okay? And so given a primary phi, primary operator, you can construct this state by acting with the primary operator at the, on the vacuum, right? So, like that. And this is this example of the operator state correspondence. So for a given state, I can associate an operator, phi zero. And then the question is, that's where we started yesterday, is what is the operator in the conformal field theory that would create this state? Okay? So now we want to find the operators that, when acting on the vacuum, create a descendant state. Okay. Once you have the, so, and the name will be, so it will be an operator, and we will call it like this. So we will use the same notation. Except I'll call it a hat, and I'll choose a. We will find out exactly what these guys are very explicitly for the free scalar, so that it doesn't look like abstract nonsense. What I'm doing here. So it's going to be an operator like that, that when acts on the vacuum, precisely corresponds to this thing. And now I want to know, how do we construct these operators that have this property? I already was motivating yesterday that the descendant operators, from the intuition already from higher dimensions, these are operators that you obtain by acting with the raising operators, or with the generators of the conformal algebra that do not annihilate the primary. Okay. So the way to fish out what the expression of the descendant is take, is from the OPE. So from the OPE of the stress tensor with the primary, okay? And now let me write it in this way. This is just a name. So we know that for a quasi-primary, for a primary, at most you can have, the singularity that you can have is a double pole. So let's call it this way. Okay, let me click that. Let me distinguish. Okay, and so on. And then the other ones, so this one is already irregular, right? As Z approaches W. And then, okay, if you want to write the other ones, well, I don't have to write the other ones. I mean, then you have just Taylor series expansion in Z minus W with increasing powers of the mode in the Virasoro generator. So I mean, more compactly, you can write this as sum from n from 0 to infinity of L minus n hat by W times Z minus W n minus 2. So now we want to start understanding. So these guys, we already know what they are. We gave it this fancy name, but we already know what they are because we know how a primary transforms under scaling transformations and translation. We knew that the operator L not high, L not hat phi at W is essentially phi by W. Okay. So this letter for the zero mode is just essentially just giving back the primary itself. For the L minus one operator, what is this guy?
The derivative.
Sorry?
The derivative.
Will be the derivative. And so on, okay? So now the question is, how given an explicit conformal field theory, how do we find the explicit operator representation of these modes? Okay. That's what I started to do yesterday. The way you would do it is that you want to invert the Lorentz series and fish out the relevant term in the OPE of the stress tensor. So let's invert this Lorentz series. So let's write. The most difficult part of doing this is getting the ends with the right signs and so on, but so please check me. A contour integral around the location of this operator of Tz phi w z minus w to the n minus 1. Okay. So all that I did here is multiply. If I want to pick up the simple pole here, I have to multiply here by z minus w to the power 1 minus n. Integrate. So if I integrate, I just pick this, right? And then I have to integrate the left-hand side. Good. So we can explicitly construct what the operator that appears, given an explicit conformal field theory, the operator that appears in any given descendant just from evaluating this contour integral of the OPE. Okay. So now let me do a couple of examples, as I said, so that doesn't look like abstract nonsense. So let me take a trivial example that will teach us a lot, which is take the primary operator to be the identity operator in the conformal field theory. So this will be very, very simple. So take Tz times the identity, okay? So the first thing to know about the identity is an operator that has a scaling weight zero. So we'll get, okay, if you want, zero over z squared, but it has scaling weight zero. The first order pole will give us the derivative of the operator, but the identity operator is precisely an operator that is translationally invariant, so the derivative vanishes. So have the derivative identity times z, but this is zero. Okay, and then this for this particular OPE, the OPE stops here. Okay, so now I use the fact that tz times the identity is tz. Okay, so what this tells us from these definitions that we have here is that Tz is L minus 2 hat of the identity. Okay. And this is the thing I ended up yesterday saying, that unlike in higher dimensions, Tz is a descendant of the identity operator. Okay. Now, let's do a more exciting case. So let's consider the case. There was one, not two. Let's consider the case where phi, the operator phi, is x, where x is a free scalar field. Okay, this is exactly the guy that you were playing around yesterday in the tutorial. Okay. And now what I want to compute essentially is, the question is, what is L minus n hat of x? So what are the descendant operators associated to x? Okay. So in order to do that, we just have to compute the OPE, right, of the stress tensor, so with x. You essentially did that yesterday, or something very close to it. Remember that dz is just minus the normal order product of dz dz. This is a holomorphic operator of dimension 2. And now to compute the OPE, all that I need is the weak contraction of xz with xw is minus 1/2 the logarithm of z minus w squared. Okay. So now let's calculate the OPE of the stress tensor with the field x itself.
Excuse me.
Yes.
What did you write for the stress tensor?
The delta partial x partial x.
Yeah. How can you explain why that is?
So did you do a tutorial yesterday?
It's in the
folder. Oh, okay, it wasn't the tutorial.
It was the tutorial.
It's in the homework.
Oh, because you haven't looked at the homework yet. So that's something that you're supposed to do in the homework. Yeah.
Okay, okay.
Yeah.
That's fine.
But remember that the stress tensor, if you were thinking of deriving it from varying the metric, you would take the kinetic term and vary the kinetic term with respect to the metric, and we'll give you something that has two derivatives. And it has to be holomorphic, and it has to be dimension 2, so hopefully this is a reasonable. But that's something that you have to do. It's straightforward, it's not a problem. So now, in order to compute the OPE, what you have to do is to contract this operator with this. And there are two ways this can happen. This operator can contract either with the first guy or the second guy. So you get a combinatorial factor of 2. So I'm going a bit slowly over this, but I guess it doesn't hurt. Times dx evaluated at z times the derivative with respect to z of minus 1/2 of the propagator, right? Okay, so let's do it. So this gives us essentially dx z times z minus w, right? But in order to, now what you have to do, which is fortunately simple, we have to evaluate the right-hand side as the location of this operator. Okay? So now all that I have to do is a Taylor series expansion of partial x around the point W. Okay? But we know what this is. Finite plus or written it more compactly is the sum from 0 to infinity 1 over n factorial the n plus 1 derivative of x evaluated of w times z minus w, n minus 1. Okay. Is it clear what I did here? Notice that this guy, DOP in this case, does not have a double pole term. Why is that?
Which is not primary?
Well, no, no. The real reason is that the scaling dimension of X is in some sense zero. Okay. There is some subtlety with free scalar fields in two dimensions, but essentially that is the statement that the dimension you compute here would be zero for the scalar. Okay, so then we have this expansion. Now we can start reading off the various terms. So in particular, we have that. So from here, we extract that L minus 1 hat acting on X of W is just a derivative operator. That we know anyway, that's true for any primary. So for any phi, it's always the case that L minus 1, that the first descendant is just the derivative. But now we can compute explicitly the second descendant. That we just get from the zeroth order term in the OPE, and so on. Okay. So that in general, just by looking at the term L minus n hat of X, the W is 1 over 1 n minus 1 factorial times the nth derivative of X. Another statement is that, for example, the state the descendant, for example, just to choose something, L minus 2 acting on H is created precisely by the operator L second derivative of X at 0 acting on it. Okay. And so on, and so on, and so on. Okay. Do people understand why, for example, this guy is not a primary? So I said that this guy is a descendant, right? Because I obtained it from the OP of X with the stress tensor. So maybe that's something that you can try to convince yourself. Or how would you diagnose that if I just give you this operator, how would you know whether this guy is a primary or not? Someone know? Well, it's clearly not a primary because it's a descendant, but how would you know now that? How do you know that this guy is a descendant? Precisely. So you would recompute now the stress tensor.
If I have all the higher order balls, it's not a primary.
Excuse me?
So if I have higher order balls, it's not primary.
Precisely, yeah. So now if you compute the OPE of this, of the stress tensor with this guy, you will find that you have higher order balls. Higher order means higher than. So definitely the center. Yes.
And one question. Here in this correspondence between state and operator, the operator is applied to 0 or to H?
Oh, sorry, this was a mistake. Yeah, this is to 0. Yeah. Good. Yes. Thank you.
And
John?
Yes.
I would have expected L minus 1 square acting on H to be the second derivative?
That's something that's also, so so right now I'm just talking about the first tower of descendants that you act with acting with one L, okay? The thing that I am leaving as an exercise, maybe Anna, is to derive exactly what you're saying. For example, what would be the descendant operator associated to L minus M, L minus M acting on X? Tomorrow you can tell me the answer.
question?
Yes.
I'm not sure I fully understand really the difference between L and the operator L.
So this L is something that maps states to states. This L hat is an object that maps operators to operators. This is an operator at the end of the day, right? So this is just a name for an operator. And this is just a way of labeling. Maybe but that's the standard, unfortunately, language that's used in the literature. That's just a name for an operator. That's why, actually, in the literature, they usually don't put a hat. I'm putting it a hat to precisely try to make a difference between LN acting on states and then just the label of an operator. I think this example hopefully helps in distinguishing the two.
Let me have a question.
Yes.
Here, this hget, it's the scalar applied in the backend, right?
Yes.
But why do you label it with h if you explicitly know what is its dimension?
No, because label it however you want. I mean, I use a language h as a general state that is created from a primary. That's all.
But okay. But then given that the dimension is zero. The vacuum also has dimension zero, so I...
Yeah, so that's what I said. So that's where X, in some sense, X itself is a very badly defined field in two dimensions because of prolonged infrared fluctuation. And it's not, in some definite sense, it's not a good conformal field. So the guy that's really well defined are the derivatives of X. But these are subtlety. So that's one of the problems when you try to teach conformal field theory. You're going to use the free theory, but then the simplest example is crappy because X is not a good field. Because of this infrared fluctuation. On the other hand, you can talk more general, but then it looks too abstract. So the answer is that X has problems in itself. But the fermion doesn't have, so that's why you will do an exercise with the fermion. The psi itself, a fermion in two dimensions, doesn't have any of the infrared problems that X has. One more thing that might be useful is that, and if you take the string theory course, you will find it there. Remember that earlier in yesterday's lecture, I mentioned that given any primary operator, you can do a Lorentz expansion in terms of Fourier modes, or something like this. Right? That's why I'm using delta x. This delta x is the guy that really is better defined. Doesn't have any of these nasty logarithmic divergences. And now you might wonder, what is the relation between the descendants that we obtain by acting with L minus n on the vacuum with this oscillator mode. Okay. And now something that you can easily show. So I already told you what the operator representation of the descendants was, just derivatives of x. And now you can show, so maybe that's a good problem for the tutorial, show that alpha. Again, using the usual trick of inverting the Lorentz series, that alpha minus n, which is the contour integral around the origin of dz, delta x z to the n. So here, all that I did is multiply both sides by z to the n, right? I picked up the pole. I do the contour integral, this just gives me alpha n. Okay, then I change the mode because I'm more interested in the creation operator. So usually alpha with negative modes are the creation operators, alpha with positive modes are the initialization operators. And from here you get that this, if I want to keep the factorial, is n minus 1 factorial, the nth derivative of x. Okay. So you see that if you want to use this language, which is sometimes useful, and in fact it's used usually when you do quantization of the string, you can create the descendant in the tower by acting with this mode, with alpha minus 1, alpha minus 2, and so on. Okay. Good.
Can I have a question? In this summatory, should it be to the minus n or to the n? Because then, if you multiply it, your beep, it's the end will be positive, will be up.
But notice that I did a quick footstep for you. I changed the modding of alpha to minus n.
Okay.
Okay, so this story was to construct, when we look at the states that you construct in the Virchow algebra, these are the, what we did is to give you a construction of how to construct the corresponding operator for all states that are obtained by acting with 1L. It should be clear now how to construct the operator when the state it has more than one Virchow generator acting on it, okay? In particular, at level 2, which I just mean states that will be created by the action of two Virchow generators, okay? The question that you would want to do, but we will not get into details because we will not need that in a lot of detail in this course. Essentially, what we want to know is what would be the corresponding operator. So for every state, there's a corresponding operator. That's the operator state correspondent. Okay. So we know how to construct the operator. We have one guy. Now we have two guys. How do you do it? Well, the logic should be clear. What you should have to do is not to get more and more descendant in the tower, you have to act with the stress sensor again. Okay? So going down in the tower, if I have k L's acting on the primary, the corresponding operator is obtained by acting k times the stress sensor on the primary. Okay? And looking at the right term in the series. Okay? For example, so maybe just as a concrete exercise, try to show by identical logic to what we did here that the operator L minus 2 hat phi w is the contour integral of dz, where the contour encircles the operator of the OPE of the stress sensor, but not with the primary, but with the operator associated to this guy, which was L and now you have to get the right power. And now you can try to compute this, say, for a free scalar field. What would the operator associated to L minus 2, L minus 3 would be for the free scalar field? Okay.
Why is this not the definition? Like, what's the definition then of the left-hand side?
Sorry?
What is the definition of the left-hand side?
It's the operator, it's the definition. It's the operator that on acting on the vacuum creates this state. So the way to think about it is that you can do it sequentially. You first create the state, okay? We just constructed the operator dual to it. If I now want, now actually what I want is another descendant of that state, which was already itself a descendant. So what you have to do is act on the operator corresponding to this state with the stress tensor again. And that's exactly what we're doing here. So I'm acting the stress tensor on the first descendant. So if you want to do a very fancy operator, all that you would have is many. Either you can write multiple contour integrals with multiple factors of t of products of t times a primary, or you can do the contour integral sequentially, and like I did here. So for this guy, I'm already using that we know what this operator is, the first descendant. Okay, so since life is short, I'll move on from this. This kind of finishes the operator set correspondent. The main message I want you to remember here is that the states and operators fit into representations of the Virchow algebra that close among themselves. And one thing that we will want to explore soon, do I have it in my notes? That I want to show you that will be crucial for us is that we will see that the correlation functions of the descendants are uniquely fixed in terms of those of the primary. And we will see that for very special values of the central chart and of H, okay, we will show that the correlation functions of descendants vanish. It will mean that there are certain states, certain descendant states in the representation that have a zero inner product with all other states in the conformal field theory. In the operator language, what this will mean is that the correlation, that correlation function with a descendant, a very specific descendant, will vanish. But since we know how to write the correlation function of descendants in terms of those of primaries, this will give us a differential equation for the primaries, which we will solve and then completely determine the theory. Okay? But we'll get there. It's just to keep you in the loop.
Jamie?
Yes?
Can you please go back to the operator product expansion there? Then how you got the L0.
How did I get there?
The operator expansion on the second box.
Sorry. So, I mean, you want to know what is the operator product expansion, or where does it come from?
Yes. Well, why did you write it?
Okay, so that's something that, so the operator of the expansion is, as I said, is when it is true in any field theory. So you have two operators and you bring them together. You can always decompose the product of these operators by a sum of a linear combination of all kinds of operators. Okay? So in principle here, all I'm doing is doing the OPE by rewriting the product of these two operators as Z approaches W as an infinite sum of operators. What's special about this OPE in this case is that if phi is primary, it doesn't have higher order four. But otherwise, I'm writing the most general terms that can appear in the OPE of two operators.
Okay. So that's the sort of definition of the operators.
Yeah, so this is, again, these are just names for the guys that appear in this Taylor series, if you want, of the OPE of two operators. But again, this is not abstract nonsense. I mean, we constructed explicitly what these operators are, say, for the free scalar field. Good. So now what I want to do is, now that we understand the structure of the Hilbert space of the CFT, what I want to show is how the constraints of unitarity will give us very interesting results about the allowed values of the dimensions of operators and of the central charge. Okay. And by pursuing the consequences of unitarity, we will arrive at this infinite sequence of conformal field theories that we'll be able to solve, which are the minimum models. Okay? But for the time being, what I want to discuss is unitarity bounds. Okay. Essentially, what I want to do is extract the consequences that unitarity in the Hilbert space of the conformal field theory imposes on the spectrum of dimensions of the theory and on the central charge. Okay. So, as I said before, the states, so given a primary, an arbitrary descendant can be written in this way, so use this notation. Again. Okay. So, what does unitarity mean? Okay. So in order to extract the concept of unitarity, what we have to do is look at the inner product. So you have a basis of states in the Hilbert space. And you want to compute the overlap or the norm of any two states. In principle, you want to so this gives you a big matrix of inner products, and you want to study under which conditions, once you analyze that matrix, the eigenvalues of that matrix are positive. If you have an eigenvalue that's negative, it means that you have a negative norm state, which is not allowed by unitarity, of course. Unitarity means that the norm of states are positive definite. So what we want to do is to calculate essentially the overlap of two states, say k prime h, k h, and study its positivity properties. Okay, so there are two immediate things that you can say about this matrix of inner products. The first one, and I leave you, it's really very simple, but I want you to think about it, so please try to prove it, is that if I allow here h1 and h2, in general, two different dimensions, that this matrix, first of all, requires that this inner product will be proportional to delta h1 over h2, so that you get a non-zero inner product only if h1 equals h2. That you already know, essentially, from the two-point function, right? Remember that this inner product can be represented in the operator land as a two-point function of two operators, and we derive from word identities that the two-point function of two primaries is zero unless the dimensions are identical, if you remember. Okay. The other thing that you can also show is that this is proportional to a delta function. So now that these guys are the same, so let me just erase them, otherwise you get zero. This overlap will be zero unless the sum of k's, k prime here equals the sum of k's here. Okay? If the energy, another way of saying it is, if the energy or L0 eigenvalue of this state and this state is different, this is automatically zero. And to convince yourself, just it's a two lines proof, but I wanted to try to prove it. Okay. So only states that have the same energy can mix in the ground matrix. Essentially, in order to find the matrix of inner products, you can work diagonally. So you can start with the primary, and then you can look at blocks. So I'm going to use this notation that the norm of k, which means the total mode number of the state is 1. Here, and everyone else is 0, right? And so on. So now, essentially, what we want to do is study the inner product on each of these blocks, okay? And study the eigenvalue.
So the x's mean that that's also a KK.
Yes. OK, did I make a mess? Yeah, so this was supposed to be k equals 1, and this was supposed to be k equals 2. So it's only along the diagonals that you get something which is non-zero. OK, so let's study at level 1. OK, so which are the states at level 1? How many states do we have?
Yeah, but can you please repeat what you meant by the norm of k?
It just means the norm of k. Okay, this is a notation for the sum over all ki in this state. Yeah. Essentially, I mean, and what is this physically? It's the L0 eigenvalue of the state, right? Because if I want to measure the charge of L0 of this state, I act with L0 and commute it through using the fact that L0 with L minus k is k L minus k. You find, by sequentially commuting it, that the energy of this descendant is the mod k plus h. So what would be the level 1 state?
L minus 1.
So there's only L minus 1? So now, we want to compute this inner product. So we have to compute this, and now use the fact, remember, that L n dagger is L minus n. That's why we went through that exercise. So the norm of this state is H L1 L minus 1 H. People agree with this? So now we want to compute this. What is this? So the way to compute it is I want to move L1 to the right because we know that L1 positive frequency or annihilation operators kill primers. So I want to write this as the commutator of L1, L minus 1, plus L minus 1, L1. But this guy just vanishes, right? Because when L1 acts on the primary, it vanishes. And now what we use is that this guy is 2L0. And now we use the fact that L0 acting on the primary of scaling weight H gives you H. Is an eigenvector of L0. So from here we get 2H and H. Okay. So from here we already extract something that I mentioned several times during the course, which is important. So now unitarity requires that this product is non-negative. Okay? It means that the norm of a state should have it should be a non-negative number, should not be a negative number. So from here we extract the powerful consequence that the dimensions of all primary operators in any unitary conformal field theory should be non-negative. Okay? Now let's assume let's study this a bit further. When H saturates to be zero, okay, and let's understand what that implies. So let's take now, take h equals 0, okay? This implies from that equation that the norm of this state, that inner product that I wrote there, can be exactly the same as this, right? This guy is 0 when h is 0, right? That's what we just derived. But what's the only situation in which this thing can be zero? Only if the thing inside the object vanishes, right? So from here we obtain that L minus 1. So if I write it in the operator language, this would be L minus 1 hat phi vanishes. So this guy vanishes precisely when L hat minus 1 phi vanishes. But we already derived for any primary operator what L minus 1 hat acting on phi is the derivative operator. Okay. So this implies that the derivative of phi vanishes. Okay. And the only operator that is annihilated by the derivative is the identity. Okay. So this would imply that phi is proportional to the identity. So in a sensible conformal field theory, there is if you have an operator, the only operator that has dimension zero is precisely the identity operator. Okay. Good. So this already has the first constraint on H. Now imagine we want to see whether we can find some constraints.
A question?
Yes.
Now you mentioned that you have problems with the scalar fields, but the scalar field would also have dimensions.
Yeah, but in some sense, the scalar field is not a well-defined field. That's the problem. So if you look at the assumptions that go into this, it has a very serious problem because of the infrared divergence.
Question?
Yes.
When you write the operator equation L minus 1 of pi equals 0, how can you get that from that acting on the vector?
So this was the discussion before of the operator state correspondence. So we have a state. We have this state. And I said that any state can be obtained by writing down an operator that acting on the vacuum gives you that state. And that's exactly what this operator is.
But doesn't that only give us this operator product acting on the vacuum? Why is the operators themselves here?
No, but OK, so you have a vacuum which is non-zero. How can this be non-zero?
This could be a lowering operator.
Sorry?
It could be a lowering operator that kills the vacuum.
No, but the lowering operator would have been zero even before it started. I mean, I'm looking at raising operator.
It means L minus 1 pi together.
Sorry?
What if L minus 1 pi together is not zero, but lower operator.
Sorry,
L minus 1 pi as an operator in total. This could be a lowering operator. That's the question.
No, by assumption, no, because phi is a primary. So L minus 1 acting on phi is a descendant. It's a raising operator, it's not a lowering. It increases the energy, not decreases the energy.
Yeah, but if I can comment, I guess the important point is that there's a one-to-one correspondence between the states and the operators. So they're committed by ejection, if you want to use that terminology. So the only way to get a zero, the only way if you hit the vacuum state with something that gets zero, the only way to do that is with the zero operator, because they're in one-to-one correspondence. Is you can't have two separate operators that can be the same state. So if something gives you zero, it's only the zero operator.
Yeah. So now I want to study running late. So now I want to start some constraints on the values of the central charge imposed by unitarity, OK? So here, so can someone?
One question that
yeah.
It cannot be zero, but it can always be one.
Excuse me?
I mean, we have that it shouldn't be, I mean, this bound that if it is zero is the identity, what is it telling us?
That in a unitary conformal field theory, the only operator that can have dimension zero is the identity operator. So just extending that logic, can someone guess what kind of inner product I should look at to determine to get some constraints on C?
So something with the stress energy.
The zero state?
Sorry?
The zero state?
Zero state.
With the L zero?
No.
For something
first of all,
the second level?
Sorry?
Yes. The second level?
Okay, so in particular, which inner product want me to look at?
The inner product of L2 with itself. Not that that's or
yes. So this guy again, you can write as L minus 2 H norm squared. So this guy is definitely positive definite, right? And now just use the Virasoro algebra again. So I write this as the commutator plus the other ordering, L2 acting on H vanishes, right? Because it's the primary. And now you have to use the Virasoro algebra. Notice that it was important to use here higher modes, higher than one. Because remember that we said the central charge only appears when you include higher modes, right? For L0 and L minus 1 doesn't appear, so that's why we learned nothing. From looking at those modes, we have to look at higher modes. And then just using the form of the Virasoro algebra here, you get Okay, so you get 2h. Sorry, 2n. Okay, so 4n. 4h plus 112 c n square n square minus 1. Okay. This has to be positive definite. Okay. Now, in particular, let me look at what this implies for the identity. So that h is 0. It implies that, well, 112 of c. Actually, so n, sorry. So n would be 2 here, right? You could have, the same item would apply line by line if I put here L minus N, Ln. All that matters is that this guy is the norm of a state, so that's positive definite. So now, using the fact that I can apply this formula for any primary, in particular for the identity, which is always there in the conformal field theory, this implies that this guy is positive definite. So which means that unitarity requires the central charge to be positive definite. Okay. So far, the two constraints that unitarity have imposed is that both C and H are positive definite. It's already a very powerful statement. Because there are conformal, okay. You can construct conformal field theories that have negative central charge, but then they're not unitary. So this, some very simple principles of quantum mechanics really gives a huge constraint on the spectrum of operators and central charge in the CFT. So far, what we would say from this analysis so far, so if I draw, say, C and H, what we find is that we can only be in the first quadrant of the HC plane. Okay. But now we will see that by analyzing the other blocks in this matrix of inner product, that there will be regions in this first quadrant that will be that will have to be eliminated in order to be unitary. Okay? Because there will be regions here in which the inner product will be negative, and therefore not unitary. So let's see how this happens for level 2. So now what I want to do is analyze the level 2 block. So what are the states now? Okay, so what are the states?
L minus
1, L minus 2. Okay. L minus 1 squared?
L minus 1, L minus 2, 0.
No, but, so I want k to be 2.
Okay.
So
have L minus 1 squared.
Yeah, so I have, so I want to compute essentially this matrix. So I want to compute L. So what else do I have?
L minus 2.
Yeah, so we have, that's it, right? This is the number of ways of partitioning 2. There are 2 ways. I want to compute the inner product of these 2 states with itself. Okay. So now this will be a 2-way 2 matrix because I have 2 states and I have to compute the overlap of any 2 states with everyone else. The calculation is kind of identical to what I did here. So I'll just write down the answer of the 2-way 2 matrix that you get. You get h squared plus 4h. You get 6h here. 6h. Of course, it's symmetric. And 4h plus c. And you would know how to compute this. For example, for this matrix element, what you would have to do is compute the overlap of L minus 1 squared with L1 squared, just commute L1 squared through, and you will get this number. Okay? This is something that you will work out in the tutorial. There is no point in me doing this algebra in the blackboard. And something that will be very useful, so this is a two-way two matrix. Let's call it M at level 2. It's the matrix of inner products at level 2. And what we're interested for unitarity will be to study the determinant of this matrix. Okay. So one thing to realize, the thing that will be useful for us to fish out the consequences of unitarity is to know the determinant of this matrix is a polynomial of degree 3 in the dimension. Okay. That's clear because we have x cubed here. And it will be very useful for us to make explicit the zeros of this polynomial. Okay, so I'm going to write this as the polynomial of degree 3. So I'll isolate the three zeros. I have 8. I will use this notation, and it will be clear why. This will be very useful notation. So I have a 0 at h11, a 0 at h12, and a 0 at h21. And these zeros are obtained by just factoring this determinant. So h11 is just 0. h12 is a bit more nasty, but still can be written in the blackboard. And h21 almost the same.
Okay. There's an overall constant factorized from the determinant.
I'm not keeping track of it yet. So what we care about, so there may be some factor of 2 to 7 or something. Yes. I'm not sure I keep track of it. What we really care about in this game are the zeros of this determinant. Okay, and the fact that this number is, of course, positive. So there might be a constant here that you don't really keep track of, which is positive. Constant just means a number, a numerical number, like 2, 4. Okay. Okay, so now the point is that unitarity unitarity implies that the determinant of this matrix has to be non-negative, okay? Very good. So now we can already see that something interesting is happening. So now let's plot. It will be easier to plot. Okay, let me not plot just yet. I mean, do you see a place, a range of h for which this determinant becomes negative? If the determinant becomes negative, the theory is not unitary, right? It means that there are states of negative norm. So if you stare at this matrix, at this determinant, sorry, for which values of h does it become negative?
H between h12 and 2 to 1.
Precisely, yeah. Because if h is between h12 and h21, one of these two guys is negative. Good, so and in terms of pictures, the way you can see that is, let's plot h squared with t, and let's draw this curve. This goes all the way to c equals 1. And there is a curve that ends at c equals 1. This is the curve associated to the 1 to 2, 0. And then there's a corresponding curve associated to the 2, 1, 0, okay? And what you've noticed is that the determinant of the matrix becomes negative precisely in this region, okay? So for h between h12 and h21, the theory is not unitary. So at level one, we had this picture that anywhere in the first quadrant was an allowed point as far as unitarity is concerned. And what this shows that is that if we start analyzing the constraints of unitarity at higher level, there are regions in the first quadrant that have to be excluded. Okay? So in particular, we excluded this particular region. So any theory that has an H between, that has a central charge and dimensions where H lies between these two curves is not a unitary theory. Okay? So we don't, okay. We don't care about it, it's a strong statement, but it's not unitary. Okay. Is the logic clear? Yes.
I must admit that I don't see why the determinant being larger than zero means that the theory is unitary. Because aren't the norms that we're looking at the diagonal entries?
Yes, imagine you diagonalize this metric.
Yeah.
If there was any state with negative norm, you would have negative eigenvalue. We have negative determinant. A necessary condition for unitarity is that the determinant is positive definite.
But it's not sufficient.
It's not sufficient. So then you have to work hard, and that's what the mathematician did. So this was a necessary condition, that the determinant is positive definite. Imagine you have a state. Imagine this state, you diagonalize it, and the norm had a negative eigenvalue here.
Yeah.
Then the determinant would be negative.
Okay, but if you add two negative.
Yeah, so I want to say that's
oh, okay.
It's a necessary condition. And this is a rather subtle analysis that even DeFrancesco, being DeFrancesco, like five, I don't know how many pages it is, he doesn't really present the full analysis of the unitarity constraints. It's a quite involved calculation in general. In general, what you have to do is calculate the formula for the determinant of the inner product of states for an arbitrary k. Okay. There's a famous formula known constructed by Kac that generalizes this. Essentially, he found a very clever way to identify all the zeros of the polynomial. So essentially, the determinant of this inner product of states is a polynomial of high degree as a function of h. He identified all the zeros. And then by studying very carefully that, you can extract all the unitarity regions. And essentially what happens is that as you keep increasing k, so this was for k equals 2. More regions in this quadrant get eliminated. Get unforbidden. By unitarity. Okay? So we'll see that there are more and more and more regions included by unitarity. One might worry that whether we're since there is an infinite number of levels that you can go down, whether at the end of the day the whole thing will be eliminated. And the thing that's an amazing result of this analysis is that this space, at least for C less than one, okay, so for C less than one. So let me tell you what the conclusion of this rather technical analysis is. Conceptually, it's very clear what we're doing. We're just computing matrix of inner products and ensuring that it's positive definite. And map out the regions where this happens. So after going through this, at some point, maybe in the next lecture, I will write down the CAC determinant. But right now, I don't think I really need it. So let me not write it. But it will be important when we study minimal models. So the conclusion of this unitarity analysis is the following, okay? So there are two interesting regions here. There was this region with C less than one, okay? If you really want to understand this, it's a good exercise to repeat this analysis for the level three. At level three, it's still quite manageable. You have three states. You have 3x3 metric, so you can still write it down in a piece of paper, and can play the same game, look, factorize the determinant, look at the zeros, and see that extra regions there will be eliminated by this analysis. Doing this for all possible levels arrives to this conclusion. For C less than one, there exists an infinite family of the called discrete models which are unitary. Okay? And they have very specific, the thing that's special about these theories is that these theories exist for very special values of C, which have rational values, and also for very specific values of the dimensions of the primaries in that theory. So let me write down what they are. So the theory will be unitary if C is 1 minus 6 divided by m plus 1, where m is any integer, positive integer. And the theory has a finite number of primaries, HRS. So RS labels which primary I'm talking about. And the dimensions are given by this number. And RS takes values. Yes?
I didn't get what happens when C equal 1 minus 6 over
n. That only at those values of C, so after I'm done erasing all regions that are disallowed, I'm only left with discrete values of C where the theories could be unitary. So out of the whole messy quadrant.
At some value of C, you will have like some non.
Yes, so it really means that inside this strip, so now I'm evaluating the C less than one domain. C less than one domain. So we already know that only the first quadrant survives. So what I'm saying is that inside this domain, the only possible unitary theories are living at very specific values of C, okay? And furthermore, at very specific values of H, which are those values of H. So essentially everything is eliminated up to like
it's supposed to be region.
Yeah, but at the end, when you do all this analysis, you're left with points only.
That's, only four?
Yes.
Oh, okay. So
out of this method, like a few oases here and there where the theory can be unitary.
So if you're stuck in a theory like that, you can't do any sorts of flows to other theories close to it.
No, you do. In fact, all these minimal models, you can flow from one to the other.
But it's not continuous in some way.
Continuous in what?
I mean, the value of C will have to jump its function.
But that's part of the story. We're saying that C is a quantity that measures the number of degrees of freedom and that decreases under RG flow. So start with some guy here up in the family which has a large central charge. You can add a relevant perturbation, a relevant operator to this theory, and it will flow to a different conformal field theory that has a smaller central charge.
But it's still continuous.
But this is only conformal. Along the flow, the theory is not conformal. So unitary.
Well, will it still be unitary along the flow?
Well, if the perturbation is done by a Hermitian operator, yes. Like, there are people that study, like in statistical mechanics, sometimes it's useful to start with one of these CFTs. And you can turn, you can deform the theory by a relevant operator, which is not Hermitian, like putting an I there. And that is interesting for a statistical mechanics application. But then the theory is not unitary or reflection positive. But for most of the applications that I have in mind, you deform by a well-defined operator, and the theory will be unitary anywhere along the flow. But along the flow, of course, none of these constraints apply. It only applies at the fixed point or the regularization group. I mean, if you have a Lagrangian and the Lagrangian to zero order is Hermitian, the theory will be unitary.
Yeah.
Okay, I didn't finish the...
Hey, one final question. So given a central charge, do we have to have all the or all these primary operators, or they are allowed, but we don't need to have them all?
As we will see, all of them have to be there in order for the OPEs to close. But this we will see more explicitly when we study in detail what the CFTs are. Okay. So here, these values of R and S label the spectrum of primaries. They tell you which primaries you have. And R is an integer that goes between 1 and m. M labels which minimal model. These are called the unitary. Okay, so these are called unitary. Minimal models. Okay. So R goes between 1 and M, and S is smaller than R. Okay. So if you wish, you could draw a lattice of points here. And you're only keeping a discrete set of states in one of the quadrants. Okay. So this would be, I guess, R, L, S, and this would be R. So you're keeping a discrete set of points of operators here. Very good. And in particular, included in this family will be a very important representative for us. Will be for m. Okay, now I'll, for m equals 3. So that the central charge will be 1/2. This will describe the universality class. Of the two-dimensional Ising model. And when we study this, what we will see is that the spectrum of primaries in this particular conformal field theory are in correspondence with the various terms. So when you write the Ising Hamiltonian in the lattice, you've seen that before, but we'll write it again. The spectrum of operators are in one-to-one correspondence with the deformations that you can add to the lattice Hamiltonian. Okay. And this can, and we will establish the dictionary when we study that. But the point is that for any other value of m, there is a corresponding lattice model that you can write down in such a way that the operators of the conformal field theory are in one-to-one correspondence with the deformations that that lattice Hamiltonian can have. So like changing the temperature, turning the magnetic field, adding some chemical potential, so on and so forth. Okay. And maybe let me just now conclude with the conclusion of a similar analysis that we did for unitarity in higher dimensions. Okay. So this was constraints that unitarity imposed in two dimensions. One could imagine is, what does unitarity imply in higher dimensions? Okay. The constraints are much, much weaker because we don't have this infinite dimensional algebra. And that's why we cannot really solve any conformal field theory in higher dimensions. We don't have enough constraints and symmetries to really do it. But something simple that you can do is use exactly the same logic, okay? Construct the matrix of inner product. In higher dimensions, there is only one raising operator, right? So which is called what?
P of L minus
1. Sorry, no, K was a lowering operator, right?
But P.
P, okay. It's not like a multiple. So it's P, yeah. So remember that P, derivatives, you can construct the descendant by just taking derivatives, right? So now you can construct the matrix of inner product by studying this at level, so at level 1 you would have, okay, something like D this at level 1. At level 2, you can have two of these guys, and so on. Okay? And now you can study the metrics of inner products. In order to, just like here, the thing that was very useful to extract information was the commutation relations of the Virasoro algebra. All the juice of this analysis in higher dimensions will come from the following fact, from the following commutation relation. First, I have to, something that was very important here in deriving unitarity constraints was knowing what is the Hermitian conjugate of the conformal generators, right? That was the statement that Ln dagger is L minus N. So in high, and remember that in the lecture yesterday, what we said is that Hermitian conjugation in radial quantization so if you take an operator O dagger, what you had to do is conjugate that operator by inversion. Remember? That was the story? Okay. So if you remember what we did earlier in the course, what would be the Hermitian conjugate of P mu?
K.
It would be K. Are people happy with this? Okay. So that means that if you want to extract a useful constraint of unitarity, what we'll look is at matrix elements of states of the commutator of, essentially what I'm saying is that you can do what we did, which is look at inner product of state of this type, use the fact that P dagger is K, okay? And now use that, so in this analysis, we use the commutation relations of the Virasoro algebra. Here, what we have to use is clearly the commutation relations of P, which act on the ket, with K that act on the bra. For a primary, K kills the primary, so we have to commute P through K. And if you remember, we had this commutation relation between P and K. So this gave us the dilatation operator and the rotation. Let me see the sign. Okay. So doing a generalization of the analysis in two dimensions, now just using this commutation relation, you can derive some identities, some unitarity constraints. Now, things are a bit more complicated now because we're dealing with matrices and so on, so I'm not deriving you the relations, but if you wanted to really understand it, I would encourage you to try to extend this analysis that we did, say, at level 1, which should be simple, for in a four-dimensional theory. All that you will need to use is essentially this commutation relation. And imagine now, just for concreteness, we're in four dimensions. We know that primaries are labeled by two quantum numbers, right? Labeled by the scaling dimension, which is the eigenvalue under the dilatation operator, but also under Lorentz transformations, right? Remember that we said that the transformation properties of a conformal field in higher dimensions are specified by dimensions and Lorentz transformations. So here, you have to give a Lorentz representation. Which in four dimensions is labeled by what? So how do you label a representation of the Lorentz group in four dimensions?
Right, two half integers.
Precisely. So what you use is the Lorentz group in four dimensions is SO4. This is locally, right? That's rotation group in four dimensions. It's locally SJ2 times SJ2. So that means that in order to specify a Lorentz representation, I have to give you two spins where these Ji's are half integral numbers. Okay? And then essentially by studying the unitarity constraint for different values of J1 and J2, and following the logic that we said, you derive the following bounds. So if the operator is a scalar, so that J1 equals J2 equals 0, you find that the dimension of any primary in a unitary conformal field theory will have to have dimension bigger or equal than D minus 2, I guess I'm using. Okay, so this is true in any dimension, so for a scalar, in any dimension, in any D. In the general form with D minus 2 over 2. Okay? Now, in four dimensions, if you want to look at a vector, so operators that have generic spin J1 and J2, you find that the dimension has to be bigger or equal than J1 plus J2 plus 2. Okay. And okay, if one of them is 0, then you have to look at each of these cases separately. You cannot just take the limit here. You have to analyze each case separately. You find that this guy will be bigger than J2 plus 1. Okay. But that's it. I mean, in the case of lower dimensions, we were able to have much more powerful, a much more constraining properties in higher dimensions. And it's not very hard to show, generalizing this argument that I had here that says that if H is 0, the identity operator, that phi has to be the identity operator. One thing that you can show is that if the bound is saturated, so if delta equals D minus 2 over 2, then the corresponding operator phi is a free scalar field. You know that a free scalar field has dimension D minus 2 over 2, but you can show that. And if you look at a vector, so that this has a vector would have representation 1/2, 1/2, right? Yes?
I was wondering, how does the scaling dimension, how is it affected by if your representation is a direct sum of these representations? Like the Dirac representation is 0/2, 0.
Yes. It's always a good idea in physics to look at the smallest building block. So I'm always thinking about the reducible representation. So look at the Weyl spinner, not the Dirac spinner.
Okay. But if the actual representation is going to be a direct sum of many, then our conformal field theory will have to satisfy the constraint coming from each direct sum.
Yes. I mean, they're in different blocks, yes. So for the vector, I mean, are people happy that a vector in four dimensions is in the 1/2, 1/2 representation? Is this sounding like something you've seen before? Okay, one said yes, someone says no. Have you seen this before? Okay. Then in this case, if delta equals 3, so if the bound is saturated, the bound is saturated if and only if the vector primary will have kind of a space-time index mu. If and only if this primary operator is a conserved current. Okay. Anyway, I should probably stop, but I just wanted to mention that the same physics that went into much simpler, okay, sometimes it's more difficult, but in some other sense it's simpler. Analysis of unitarity in two dimensions exists in higher dimensions. And you can extract powerful but less powerful constraints from unitarity. And tomorrow we will really start with understanding the special conformal field theory. Yes?
A question. So delta should be less than the number D?
Less? No, delta should be bigger than D minus 2 or 2.
No, but should it be less than the number of dimensions? other signal mark.
No, no, that's the only constraint. I mean, for a scalar, that's the only constraint you have.
So you could have, say, that's a simple n.
Yeah. It's not ruled out by unitarity. And in fact, you know that there are CFTs, like any question for Superior Mill, that if you study the dimension of the operator as a function of the coupling, and the coupling is very, very large, like usually with the perturbation theory, the gauge coupling is small, but imagine it's very large, like 100, we know that the dimension grows incredibly fast. So you can have a dimension of an operator of quantum mechanics that is very large.
Yeah.
Okay.